Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Happy birthday indeed to us. We turned 2 years old on March the 1st, and I've been trying to figure out what would be a great thing to do, who would be a wonderful person to have on to commemorate our second anniversary, and I can think of no one better than Linda Greenhouse. Now, those of you who are plugged in to the Supreme Court and to constitutional law, well, for you, Linda Greenhouse needs no introduction. For the rest of you, she is a remarkable woman. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. She covered the Supreme Court for 30 years. And over that time, she's written many, many different things about today's subject, and that is Roe versus Wade. Yep, this is our first show on abortion. You knew we had to get to this topic eventually. And since Roe just turned 40 years old itself back in January, I thought this is a good time to do a retrospective. Now, Linda has actually written a book back in 2010 called Before Roe, and with a co-author, and the book takes us all the way back to the very beginning of this process, and that's where we're going to start with her right now.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm so happy to have you. Today we're going to talk about, I guess we could call it, the story of Roe versus Wade, one of the most, controversial decisions in Supreme Court history. And you, of course, with your background of so many years reporting on the court and the fact that you've written this book about the lead-up to Roe, it seems to me you're uniquely qualified to talk to us about it. So please start wherever you wish, and we'll just go from there.
Well, I'm going to start by picking up on what you just said, Roe, one of the most controversial opinions in Supreme Court history. And, of course, sitting here in February 2013, a month into the 40th anniversary of Roe, it certainly looks that way. But your listeners might be interested to put themselves back to January 1973 and understand that Roe was actually not all that controversial when it was issued, when the decision was issued.
That is shocking.
Yeah, well, you know, things did not necessarily appear then as they appear now, and I have a lot to say about that, but just to kind of reconstruct the landscape on which Roe against Wade, the decision, not Roe against Wade, the symbol, but Roe against Wade, the actual Supreme Court decision, landed in January of 1973. The public support for reforming the 19th century laws that made abortion a crime in every state had been growing very rapidly since the 1960s, impelled by a few things, but really, and this also was counterintuitive, not led by the women's movement of the late 60s, but really led by the professions of public health and law, the elites of the legal profession, the leaders of the public health profession, both have started agitating for reform of these laws that sent women into the back alleys at their peril and put doctors who were willing to perform abortions at great peril of criminal prosecution and losing their licenses. And that was a situation that did not appear to these professionals to make much sense. And so the abortion reform movement was really off and running, led by a bunch of elite men, and women came later to that movement for reasons that we can discuss. So by the time Roe against Wade was actually decided, about two-thirds of the population, polled by the Gallup organization in the summer of 1972, as the court was working on the final round of the decisional process, answered yes to this question: do you think abortion should be a decision between a woman and her doctor without involvement by the government. Two-thirds of the population said yes.
That is remarkable.
Majorities in every demographic segment, including Catholics, by the way.
Really?
Not by two-thirds, but by more than half. And very interestingly, and significantly for reasons we can discuss later, the largest segment of the population supporting decriminalization of abortion were those who identified as Republicans.
Really?
So what we've seen in the intervening 40 years is a complete flip, a complete party realignment for various reasons. So when the opinion came down, of course, it was not, as I think a lot of people probably guess, it was a hard-fought 5-4. No, it was 7-2.
Mm-hmm.
And President Nixon had put four justices on the Supreme Court, and three of those four were in the majority. That is to say, of course, Harry Blackmun, who wrote the opinion, but Chief Justice Warren Burger and Justice Lewis Powell, they were all in the majority. The two dissenters were one Nixon appointee, William Rehnquist, who later became Chief Justice, of course, and a Kennedy appointee, Byron White. And another thing people might be interested in is that their dissenting opinions were not based on what we would expect today, which would be a heartfelt endorsement of the rights of the unborn and, you know, the personhood of the fetus and so on. They were really dissents based on a disagreement over whether the court should have decided the case, a kind of a judicial activism attack on the majority opinion for various procedural reasons. So that the way abortion is discussed now and debated now in political space was not actually what was going on at that time. And in fact, newspapers in Texas, and it was a Texas law that was overturned in Roe, praised the decision. Newspapers in Georgia, and there was a companion case to Roe, which also struck down a more modern Georgia abortion law, praised the decision. And in fact, the same day the decision came down, Lyndon Johnson died. He was out of office, of course, former President Johnson died, and that's the event that got the bigger headlines in almost every newspaper.
That is just remarkable. So if I understood you correctly, it was really more of an issue for the medical establishment, and it was an issue of doctors' ability to practice the way they wanted to practice medicine. And if I also recall from your book, it was an environmental concern as well that was motivating people that wanted to increase access to abortions.
Yes, I mean, I don't think that was necessarily motivating the court, but it was part of the atmosphere that was causing people to question the old laws. It was a fear of population, burgeoning population growth.
And that's not even part of the debate anymore. And really, the medical stuff is almost tangential to the women's issues, which have taken the front seat since the decision was handed down.
That's definitely true. And you know, the women's movement came on board, as I said, a little bit late. I mean, still before Roe, but just really around the time of Roe, because the women's movement had several goals at that time, most of which were economic. That is to say, access to jobs, access to higher education. I remember back in those days, it was still extremely common for help wanted ads to be sex segregated. Help wanted men, help wanted women. Hmm. Women were simply excluded at the threshold from economic opportunity. So that was the real impetus that got the women's movement going again in the 1960s. And it was Betty Friedan, and the 50th anniversary of her great book is just being marked this month, actually. But it was Betty Friedan who made the connection between economic opportunity and the ability to control one's reproductive life.
Mm-hmm.
And she joined those two issues in a speech that she gave in Chicago. I think the date was 1969 or so. To a group of male doctors who were having the organizational meeting for the organization that eventually became NARAL. And Betty Friedan was invited to speak, and she said, I'm no great expert on abortion, but I have the only expertise that you need to hear. And she gave a very vigorous speech about making the link between reproductive freedom and economic opportunity, and that's what brought the women's movement into this fight.
That's a fascinating evolution, but before we go too far down the feminist road, let's go back to pre-Roe, and there were two stories that I got out of your book, that both of which I thought were compelling and that have been often overlooked. The first of them is simply Miss Sherry, down in the romper room story, and the other one is about Nixon and the Catholic vote. So could you tell us about those two things?
Okay, so there was a woman named Sherry Finkbein. Actually, her name is actually Sherry Chesson. She was Miss Sherry on the children's program Romper Room.
I always do what's right. I never do anything wrong. I'm a Romper Room doobie, a doobie all day long.
I used to watch that, not down there, but I used to watch it.
Yeah, it was a franchise. And so there were different hosts in different cities. I think I'm a little too old to have watched it, but I certainly knew about it. But anyway, Sherry Finkbein was a young housewife and mother who had this television show in Phoenix in 1962. She and her husband wanted a big family. They had four children. She was happily pregnant with a fifth child. When she read an article about a drug called thalidomide, was a sleeping pill and was not FDA approved for sale in the United States, but was quite popular in Europe, and her husband had picked some up on a business trip to London, brought it back, and she took a few of these pills because she was having trouble sleeping during her pregnancy, and she learned by reading this article that thalidomide was linked to the birth all over Europe of babies missing their arms and their legs.
So tragic.
It had the effect in early pregnancy of stopping limb formation. So she called her doctor and said, what about this and what should I do? And he said, well, I think this is grounds for an abortion, which, of course, was illegal in Arizona and every place else at that time, except to save the life of a pregnant woman, and her life was not endangered by this. But he arranged quietly for the hospital in Phoenix to give her an abortion, and she said, you know, other women who may be in my same position should know about this. And she was friendly with the local newspaper editor, and a story resulted that she thought was protecting her privacy, but she was such a well-known personality in town that it became public, and the hospital said, well, now this is public, we can't give you an abortion.
Oh boy.
And what women in the western part of the country at that time who had the connections and the resources would do in a situation like that was get an abortion in Japan, where abortion was legal. But the Japanese medical establishment said, oh, no, now this is public. We can't do this. So the only place in the world where she could get a safe legal abortion was Sweden. So she and her husband went to Sweden. They had the abortion. The fetus, in fact, had no arms and legs, as it turned out. And this was a story that just galvanized public attention. I was a kid at the time, and I remember sitting in the living room of my family house reading the Life magazine cover story about this case.
They put this case about abortion on the front of Life magazine?
Yep.
Oh, that is remarkable. That was sort of mainstream, middle American Saturday Evening Post type of publication.
Well, I mean, it was the first time that I had ever heard the word abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And when I later interviewed Sherry Chesson about this, and I mentioned that to her, she said she had actually never heard the word abortion either. I mean, it wasn't discussed in polite company, even though, of course, in the age of illegal abortion, hundreds of thousands, maybe 500,000 women a year were having abortions.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Linda Greenhouse about the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. Linda was just telling me the story of Sherry Finkbein, a romper room lady who was seeking an abortion for what turned out to be a very badly deformed fetus. This actually was made into a made-for-TV movie on HBO about 20 years ago.
Phoenix, 1962.
What? That was the doctor. He wants us to come into his office first thing this morning.
I think it's about those tranquilizers you brought back from Europe.
A crippling drug.
There's a chance that your baby will be born deformed.
A moral question
Now, what I'm saying is if you want a termination, I can arrange it. But you've got to keep it quiet.
Or a criminal offense.
A spokesman at the Catholic Recorder in Tucson said today, any abortion breaks the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill.
This thalidomide thing is a real horror. If you know anyone who's gotten messed up in it, you have to tell me.
I can't.
For Sissy Spacek and Aidan Quinn, it was a private matter.
I told
him. This is nobody else's business.
That rocked a nation.
What does it feel like to decide to kill your own baby?
This is a woman in need and a lousy law.
It may be a lousy law, but it's the law and we are not above it.
This is my baby! Why didn't anybody ever ask me? Take care of me!
You're not the only one having a hard time here, Sherry. Try thinking about other people for a change. I know that's hard for you, being as that you're the center of the universe, but just try, okay?
Academy Award winner Sissy Spacek of Coal Miner's Daughter and JFK and Aidan Quinn of Avalon and the Playboys star in the shocking true story the New York Times called Highly Emotional with unflinching performances. A first-rate production, said the LA Times. Spacek and Quinn reach levels of acting intensity rarely glimpsed. From the director of Crossing Delancey comes A Private Matter.
What a tragic situation. I never saw that particular movie, but it's I'm not even sure I want to see it. It's a terrible tale, a terrible situation to be in, and very prominent in the lead-up to Roe versus Wade, which is, of course, our subject today with Linda Greenhouse. After the break, we'll talk some more with Linda Greenhouse about the 40th anniversary of this very controversial decision.
Little baby in your mother's womb, you will never see a rose bloom, never see a rainbow or your birthday candlelight. But they say you have no rights. But the Lord, He formed you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Linda Greenhouse about the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. Before the break, Linda was telling me the tragic tale of Sherry Finkbein, a romper room lady who was seeking an abortion in very difficult circumstances.
This case and the extreme nature of the criminal prohibition in a very sympathetic setting really got public attention, and when I was doing research for the book, I found newspaper stories from red states, from the heartland, editorials saying, you know, does this really make sense to have forced this young woman and her husband to flee the country and go to Sweden for a medical service that seemed very well indicated? So I think it's clear that although, of course, there were 11 years between 1962 and 1973, that this injected the issue sort of into the air and caused people who never had thought about abortion, never wanted to think about abortion, to think, you know, does this really make sense? And that was part of the story. And the other question you asked me about Richard Nixon and the Catholic vote. So Richard Nixon had no particular record on abortion. Like most Republicans, in the sort of Republican establishment, I think we can assume that he didn't think much about it, but if the question had been put to him, as the Gallup poll put it, he would have said, yes, the government doesn't belong in this picture. But he was running for re-election in 1972, and he had some very smart campaign aides. Pat Buchanan may be a name familiar to people,
mm-hmm.
and Kevin Phillips, and they looked around and saw that the Republicans were, and Nixon himself, were quite successful in the so-called Southern strategy in peeling the traditional Democratic voting white voters of the South away from their home in the Democratic Party, in luring them over to the Republican Party with various code language on civil rights and race. How to work that in the North? So the Democratic vote in the North, a big part of the Democratic base, were urban, ethnic Catholic voters who had grown up voting Democratic, and how to sort of start peeling them away. Now, even though it's true that as I mentioned earlier, the Gallup poll in the summer of 1972 showed that a majority of Catholics supported the right to abortion when that question was put to them. It was a rather small minority. It was 50-some-odd percent, and there was a chance to make some inroads there. So Nixon was advised to take an anti-abortion stance. Let me interject,
because even though maybe a small majority of Catholics might have favored abortion rights at that point, if I recall, the primary anti-abortion or pro-life organization really kind of came out of the Catholic Church, didn't it, at that time?
Oh, definitely.
Okay, so those Catholics who were opposed and in the vanguard of the pro-life movement.
Well, that's true, and it's important to point out that the Church's establishment of the National Right to Life Committee and so on, this predated Roe.
Mm-hmm.
This was not a response to Roe against Wade. This was a response to the winds of reform that were blowing in the state legislatures at that time. And that's very much to the point. So in 1970, the New York legislature repealed the criminal abortion law and basically ushered in a regime of free access to abortion in the state of New York. And the Church really was extremely upset about this and launched a big lobbying campaign to get the legislature to repeal the repeal. And this was led by the cardinal in New York. And President Nixon released a letter to the cardinal endorsing this campaign and announcing his opposition to abortion. And actually, the campaign succeeded in 1972. The New York legislature voted to go back to the 19th century criminal abortion law, good old blue state New York. And that would have happened except that Governor Nelson Rockefeller, a Republican, vetoed the repeal. So this was Nixon really in a very public way joining the issue with the bishops, if not with the Catholics on the street.
Now, if I heard you correctly, though, a few minutes ago, you said at this point a majority of the Republican Party was actually pro-choice. So this
That's
was a bit,
right.
This is a bit of a risk on Nixon's part, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
He was going to alienate some of his own party members, and he was making the political calculation, it sounds like, that he wanted those conservative, socially conservative Catholics on his side more than he wanted to keep the pro-choice people in the Republican Party on his side.
Well, that's right, and I guess a political scientist at this point would talk about the concept of issue salience,
mm-hmm.
by which they would mean that the abortion issue on the right to life side mattered a huge amount to those Catholics for whom it mattered.
Mm-hmm.
But the pro-choice side, you know, was not like a front burner issue for most Republicans. If asked about it, they would say yes. They thought the old law should be reformed or repealed. But it wasn't an issue that they were taking to the streets. But, I mean, here's another example of what was going on at that time with Nixon and the Republican establishment. So in 1970, President Nixon set up a blue ribbon commission called the Commission on Population and America's Future. That is known as the Rockefeller Commission because it was chaired by, not by Governor Nelson Rockefeller, but by his brother David Rockefeller. And this was a very establishment group of business leaders and some members of the Senate and various big shots in the country, charged with coming up with a population policy for the United States. Now, that just sounds weird from our perspective today.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, what president dared to even think of doing such a thing? But it was a different era, and he did. And they spent 2 years studying this. And by the way, people who are interested, the report that the Rockefeller Commission came out with is a public document, and it's freely available on the Internet. Anyway, they came out with a set of proposals that reflected establishment thinking of that time, 1972, including access to abortion for everybody, paid for by the government if necessary,
government subsidized abortion. The Republican Party was coming out in favor of this.
Well, this wasn't the Republican Party as an entity, but it was this Blue Ribbon Commission set up by President Nixon and staffed and led by people who were members of the Republican establishment.
Wow.
Access to contraception for everybody, including minors without parental involvement, And these were their core recommendations. And this report landed in the second half of 1972 in the middle of the presidential election campaign. And President Nixon accepted the report. I mean, he physically received the report, and he disavowed it. Never said another word about it. Said that he didn't approve of abortion. That was not part of his personal philosophy. And thank you very much. And that was that. So that episode really crystallizes the what the lay of the land was. On the eve of Roe against Wade, you had a Republican establishment that believed that there should be access to abortion. You had fissures opening in the Republican Party. You had the Republican Party led by President Nixon making a big play for the Catholic vote. And so Roe against Wade lands in the middle of this. And I think the court was totally oblivious to it, as well they might have been, because one thing that's unusual about the trajectory of the case in the Supreme Court was it sat on the Supreme Court's docket for 2.5 years.
Wow.
Which is really unusual. I mean, usually a case comes in. I mean, for instance,
Linda, before we get to the details of that, and I really do want to get to that because, of course, that's the focus of the show, but it just has to occur to me that, you know, a lot of people have been talking about and writing about the historic shift in the Republican and Democratic parties that took from 1970 to where we get to today. And many people will talk about demographic changes, they'll talk about social changes, they'll talk about this, they'll talk about that. It seems that Richard Nixon specifically decided a lot of that change 40 years ago.
Well, he had the insight that it would be in his interest.
Yeah.
And he was the first Republican presidential candidate actually to get a majority of the Catholic vote in 1972. It took a long time. It took a really long time because the Republican Party had to be mobilized and motivated and around this issue. So, for instance, in the 1976 presidential campaign, more than 3 years after Roe comes down, the Republican Party platform maintained a big tent on abortion. It said, I don't have the words at hand, but it said something like, we recognize that there are difference of views on abortion in the years after Roe against Wade, and we welcome all views. That was 1976.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't until 1980 that the Republican National Platform takes an anti-abortion position and calls for the nomination and confirmation of judges who wanted to overturn Roe against Wade. So that's 7 years. And
so it sounded like within basically one decade, you go from a party of economic elites to a party of so-called values voters, socially conservative.
Well, that's right.
In one decade.
And that came about in an interesting way. So you had the Catholic Church going down this track. And on a parallel but somewhat different track, you had the conservative Protestant denominations. You had the evangelicals. Now, the Catholics and the evangelicals had never been allies about anything for, deep-rooted cultural and doctrinal reasons. There was great suspicion between one and the other. But and in fact, on the eve of Roe, as reform was moving through the country, every religious denomination felt called upon to take a doctrinal position on abortion, as many of them had not had occasion to do. And the National Association of Evangelicals, the Southern Baptist Convention, took a position, and it was a reform position. It was not categorical opposition to abortion. It was an acceptance of the notion that women under certain circumstances, health reasons, condition of the fetus, rape, incest, and so on, should be entitled to terminate the pregnancy. That was totally not the Catholic position, which was one of categorical opposition, as it, of course, still is. So on the eve of Roe, they didn't have much in common. But what happened was that simultaneously with the abortion issue getting out into public space, the Equal Rights Amendment was out in the country for ratification, having been endorsed by Congress, and had to go to out to the states. As you know, 3/4 of the state legislatures have to ratify an amendment before it becomes part of the Constitution. So the Equal Rights Amendment was out there and was generating a lot of opposition from political and social and religious conservatives. Phyllis Schlafly started this organization called Stop ERA, and she was a very smart, still is, a very smart operator, Catholic, very conservative, had cut her eye teeth in the Barry Goldwater campaign in 1964. And she, just like Betty Friedan, had made the connection between abortion rights and economic opportunity. Phyllis Schlafly made the connection on the other side of the street between the ERA and the right to abortion. She said, if we pass the ERA, that's going to give women the right to abortion, and that's a terrible thing. So this marked a kind of convergence of interest between the Catholics and the evangelicals. And that's what was going on in the later 1970s leading into the 1980s. It was something that I don't think necessarily Richard Nixon and his advisors could have anticipated. Really, they were on parallel tracks that ended up converging, and it took us into the 1980s. And I emphasize that just to say that the common notion that the court decides Roe against Wade out of the blue in January 1973 and creates this big backlash that changes our politics, you know, cannot be true. It's obviously not true because of these other trends that were moving along without respect to Roe against Wade, and in fact, without respect to even the expectation that the courts would be involved in this issue.
That is just remarkable, and you're right. Most people have no idea about this. Well, we've talked a lot about the social and political background to Roe and the strange bedfellows and the interesting alliances that developed and the machinations of Richard Nixon and all the rest of it. But let's talk about the case itself, if we may, because I remember years ago reading your other excellent book, Becoming Justice Blackmun, that there's a whole story there, too, and it ties into that medical theory stuff as well. So could we start at the beginning of the Roe case itself and talk about how it worked its way through the court and what the court did and how it reached its decision?
Sure. Well, as the winds of legislative reform started to fade because of pushback from the Catholic Church, as exemplified in that New York example, advocates for abortion reform started turning to the courts in large numbers. Roe against Wade was just one of many cases that were filling up the pipeline. In fact, at the time the court decided Roe, I think there were about 20 other cases, and Roe just happened to be first in the queue. So it comes along. Many people today say, well, you know, why did the court go off on this right to privacy? Why did they invoke a right that is not actually mentioned in so many words in the Constitution? Why didn't they go on how we have come to think of reproductive freedom as an equal protection issue, as a women's rights issue? So it's interesting to realize that in 1973, the court didn't yet have a jurisprudence of women's rights. The court had yet to announce that the equal protection guarantee of the 14th Amendment, properly understood, prohibited the government from discriminating against women or from treating men and women differently without some compelling reason.
That is a remarkable fact. That didn't even happen to what, 1976?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So we didn't have a basis for it in equal protection. We didn't have a basis for it in women's rights, and so they had to find some other constitutional foundation for you.
Oh, right. I mean, not even that they said to themselves, well, we can't use equal protection, we have to find something else. It didn't even occur to them, I believe, that equal protection was in the picture. So they what the majority in Roe did was draw on other precedents that were available to them. I mean, the most notable being Griswold against Connecticut, 1965, which was a case that found the right of married couples to use contraception as anchored in the privacy right as part of due process. And it was amazing to think that in 1965, in the state of Connecticut, and I think Massachusetts was the only other state, contraception was illegal for everybody, even married couples. So the court had struck that down, established that precedent in Griswold. And then on the eve of Roe, really kind of coexisting with Roe, there was a case called Eisenstadt against Baird that broadened the Griswold right to not just married couples, but to anybody. It's the right of anybody to decide whether to, in Justice Brennan's words, surmises that, beget or bear a child. So there were these precedents available. And if you read Roe Against Wade, and of course hardly anybody ever actually reads it, it's really surprising the extent to which it's about the rights of doctors to, as you put it earlier, practice medicine in what they deem to be the best interests of their patients. I mean, women make an appearance in Roe, of course, but not all that much of one. And so it really, the privacy right is the right of the patient, the woman, in consultation with her doctor, and by effectuating the doctor's best judgment to terminate a pregnancy.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm discussing the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade with Linda Greenhouse. What's remarkable about this circumstance is that people who are pro-life and people who are pro-choice just tend to look at it completely differently. The pro-life people, of course, are concerned with the personhood of the fetus, and the pro-choice people see this as much more of an issue of women's rights.
Women used to say,
you're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Linda Greenhouse about the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. And one of the fascinating aspects of this case is how much the original Roe decision was really written not so much in terms of women's rights, it was written in terms of doctors' rights.
Now, part of that, if I recall from your book about Justice Blackmun, was not merely the fact that that's how the issue had been cast for the preceding 10 years, but it was because Harry Blackmun himself had a very strong connection to the medical community, didn't he?
Yes, he had been the general counsel of the Mayo Clinic, and many of his best friends were doctors. He had friends who were doctors who believed in abortion reform. He had one old friend who was a very anti-abortion individual, and in Justice Blackmun's correspondence, I found a lot of letters from that man.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's important to emphasize that, of course, Harry Blackmun wrote the opinion. He was assigned to write the opinion by Chief Justice Berger, who mm-hmm. was part of the majority. But it was, in many ways, a collective effort. And, of course, he spoke not just for himself, but for seven justices. It came to be tightly connected with him, and he came to, as I discussed in the biography, to self-identify with Roe to a really striking degree, but it was the court speaking. It wasn't just Harry Blackmun speaking.
Absolutely, and that's very important to remember constitutionally, and yet I just can't resist a couple of stories that I seem to recall. It's been years since I read your book about Justice Blackmun, but I seem to recall that you said he spent the summer back at the Mayo Clinic doing all sorts of medical research, and that perhaps accounts to the extent to which the Roe decision reflects that sort of medicalization of the issue, and that he was also living with his family at home. And didn't he have a couple of daughters, and didn't his daughters and his wife all work on him every night at dinner?
Well, no, actually.
Oh, no, okay, that's just a story.
Yeah, well, he had three daughters, but he was 60 years old by the time he was named to the Supreme
right.
Court, so he no longer had children at home. I mean, they were off living their lives. And so
you've just exploded a myth.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that story. All right. Well,
it's a great story.
It's a great story. You have this idea of, well, poor old Harry just getting browbeaten and saying, okay, you all win, but I guess that doesn't fit in. The other story I've heard about him is that, as you say, he's so identified with the Roe decision, even though he was writing for a 7-vote majority, that he got more hate mail subsequently when this issue became front and center for the pro-life group than any other justice, and I heard even after he had passed away that he got more hate mail than any other justice.
Oh, that part I don't know, but he gave all of his letters, he saved them all, And he gave them, with all the rest of his papers, to the Library of Congress. And there were so many cartons of mail that the library didn't know what to do with them, and they decided to just take a representative sample and toss the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's true. I mean, people associated it so tightly with him, but actually, had he never been on the Supreme Court, the decision would have come out the same way.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy during the first 3 months belongs to the woman and her doctor, not the government. Thus, the anti-abortion laws of 46 states were rendered unconstitutional. More on this story.
So it's really a, you know, fallacy to say Harry Blackmun, gave us the right to abortion in America.
Understood. Well, so the court comes out, and as you've pointed out, what, three of the four Nixon appointees were in that seven-person majority.
Right.
Did Nixon ever express any reaction to the Roe decision? Was he disappointed in his appointments for having voted this way?
That's a good question. I think this is right, but somebody who checks the historical record might correct me, that when the decision came down, his reaction was, okay, this is no business of the federal government.
Huh, so he reverted to his earlier position.
Yeah, I mean, the federal government didn't do anything about it.
He'd won re-election, and I think he was a bit distracted with Watergate at that point,
yeah,
probably.
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, he didn't sort of need the issue anymore
at that
moment.
That's right. He'd gotten the Catholic vote already. Okay, so
I mean, the next battle came about over government funding for abortion for women who couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the Hyde Amendment, and that was a legislative matter. Henry Hyde was a congressman who was very anti-abortion, and he got in several different iterations they were appropriations measures on appropriations bills that said that the federal government wasn't going to fund abortions as part of the federal component of Medicaid. States could keep doing it, and many states, or some states anyway, have kept doing it all these years, but that became the next time that the federal government actually got involved in the abortion matter, and that was a few years down the road.
So that was mid to late 70s when the Hyde Amendment came about.
Right, right. And because it was just an appropriations rider rather than an actual statute, it had to be renewed periodically in every fiscal year, so that meant it was, an issue for Congress every year. That's why it kind of seemed to go on forever.
Right. Well, and as we know, I mean, the opposition to abortion, did coalesce. The Catholics and the evangelical Christians did come together on that issue. Other social conservatives came together on the issue. And the next great Supreme Court case on this subject was, of course, the Casey case, I believe, in 1990. And could you tell us a little bit about that, what led up to the Casey case and what the Casey case did?
Right, 1992.
92, so, okay.
Casey was a challenge to a Pennsylvania abortion law that itself was designed to push and test the Supreme Court's commitment to Roe against Wade, because in between 1973 and 1990, I guess, when Pennsylvania passed the law, the court had been, the pro-Roe majority on the court had been shrinking because of Republican appointments in the interim. So Sandra O'Connor was President Reagan's first nominee to the Supreme Court, and she had written a dissenting opinion in 1983. She came on in 1981, 1983. She wrote a dissenting opinion in a case called Akron, in which she expressed serious doubt about Roe against Wade.
Mm-hmm.
Justice Kennedy had come on the court, also appointed by Ronald Reagan. Justice Souter had come on the court appointed by the first President Bush, and Justice Thomas the same way. So it seemed objectively that the majority to support Roe against Wade was shrinking to nothing, or, to five votes anyway, which was shrinking away. So this case came to the court, and it presented a challenge to various restrictions, waiting period and informed consent and spousal notification and so on. But the real main chance was, would the court take this opportunity to overturn Roe against Wade? So the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit in Philadelphia upheld the Pennsylvania law in the fall of 1991, and Planned Parenthood was going to bring an appeal. Now, usually it takes, you have 3 months to bring a Supreme Court appeal from a lower court decision, and that would have pushed the case over into the spring of 1992 by the time the court could act on whether it was going to accept the case, and that would have meant that the case wasn't going to be argued until the fall of 1992 and decided in 1993, that is to say, after the 1992 presidential election.
Ah.
So the pro-choice groups took a look at the situation, and they figured there was a very good chance that the court was going to overturn Roe. If it was going to overturn Roe, they figured they wanted it to be before the election, not after, so that it could be an issue before the electorate, and we do have a pro-choice majority in this country. We did then, and we do now.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to accelerate the timetable. So they filed the appeal, not within months, but within a couple of weeks. So it gets onto the court calendar. It's argued in April of 1992. And which means it will be decided by the end of that term, by the end of the spring, and was decided in June of 1992. And very surprisingly, very remarkably, instead of overturning Roe against Wade, Casey reaffirms Roe against Wade by a vote of 5-4,
wow,
with the participation of Justice O'Connor, Justice Souter, and Justice Kennedy, who wrote a joint opinion which said that.
And excuse me for interrupting, Linda, but that itself is unusual. I mean, for
very unusual.
Yeah, typically the court majority will assign one justice, as they did with Justice Blackmun back in the Roe decision. But here, three people together, and the decision seems to have this sort of suggestion of resolution and finality to it.
It did. Of course, it, you know, maybe didn't turn out to be quite so final, but what they were basically saying is the courts come under a lot of political pressure,
right,
on this issue, and to yield to the political pressure would be really to weaken the legitimacy of the court, and so we're going to stand by what has been decided. The legal term for that is stare decisis,
mm-hmm,
stand by what has been decided. And so that was sort of the end of that chapter. Cause the opponents of abortion, of course, to curl up and go away. There's still been, obviously, a lot of legislative action.
Oh, sure. And let me interrupt, because I do want to get to that. Before we do, let's talk just a little bit about the actual Casey holding, because we do need to get down to the law at some point. Now, Roe had set up this idea of pre- and post-viability and had been divided up into trimesters, and there had been a fairly complicated opinion. Casey sort of simplified things, didn't it? It essentially said pre-viability, post-viability, here are the rules.
Yes, I mean, Casey replaced the standard of review. I mean, the Roe opinion had discussed abortion as a fundamental right that could not be interfered with without a compelling reason by the state.
Mm-hmm.
Casey reworks that to adopt what Justice O'Connor had earlier proposed, the undue burden standard. So a restriction on access to abortion will be held unconstitutional if it imposes an undue burden on the access, on a woman's right. So the subsequent cases from Casey have all been about what's an undue burden.
Right, and that's pre-viability. Pre-viability. So prior to the time the fetus is viable outside the mother, that is the standard, undue burden. And as you say, though, that's been the standard in all the subsequent cases. Post-viability, the state can regulate abortion, even to the point of prohibiting it.
Well, except for
right,
reasons of
the life or health of
life
the mother.
And health.
Right, so there's the exception to that prohibition rule. But basically, that's the dividing line. You've got two different sets of rules, pre-viability, post-viability, undue burden before. State can regulate afterward, with the exception that it has to allow abortions if the health or the life of the mother are threatened.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so that's the framework ever since 1992, and as you say, things have not stopped. So what's happened in the last 20 years?
Well, for instance, we've had this big fight over so-called partial birth abortion, mm-hmm. which is a method of later-term abortion. So is that an undue burden? And the court in 2000, looking at a law from Nebraska, said, yes, it's an undue burden, and this prohibition is unconstitutional. That was 5-4 with Justice O'Connor in the majority. Then Justice O'Connor retires and is replaced by Samuel Alito, and the case comes back in 2007 as a challenge to the federal ban on so-called partial birth abortion. President Clinton had vetoed this statute, but President Bush had signed it. And the court flips because Justice Alito votes differently from Justice O'Connor, and 5-4 upholds the federal law. And that's really the most recent word we've had from the court on abortion.
And the lesson there, of course, presidents matter and Supreme Court appointments matter, no matter where you are on the issue.
That's correct. I mean, the court in the second case, which is called Carhart against Gonzalez,
mm-hmm.
Gonzalez against Carhart, I guess, sort of pretended that there was a difference between the federal law and the state law. They didn't want to just say, you know, we're changing our mind because we have a new justice, but...
There wasn't a lot of difference between the state law and
the
federal
law. No, there wasn't
law.
Any reasonable difference, and so basically it was an overturning because of a change in personnel.
Yeah, and the court has done that in other areas, but this is one of the more flagrant examples of, you know, different justices, different result.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, which is, of course, what they were precisely trying to avoid with the Casey decision back in 92.
Right.
Okay, I mean, again, whatever side of the issue people are on, that's fairly clear about what happened. Now, since those decisions, and those are those sort of the latest and greatest from the Supreme Court itself, there's been lots of litigation in lower state and federal courts. And is it fair to say that it's basically been a process of more conservative legislatures and governors enacting or attempting to enact a number of restrictions that all get tested against that undue burden standard in Casey?
Yes, I mean, there have been a number of kind of authors of what have become fairly standard bills that go out in the state legislatures. There's an organization in Chicago, Americans United for Life. They've put out kind of a template, and there's a state official in Kansas, I think, a guy named Chris Kobach, who's taken it upon himself to write this kind of legislation. So various state legislatures, if they have the majority to do it, are putting these laws into effect, like women have to be shown an ultrasound of the fetus before an abortion, or long waiting periods. And South Dakota has a law that requires doctors to tell patients seeking an abortion that if they go ahead with the abortion, they will put their mental health at risk, and actually that's not true. It's been studied very intensively, and there's no evidence for that, but doctors are required by law to lie to their patients. So there's a lot of this stuff going on, and the hope of the abortion opponents is that one of these cases will get up to the Supreme Court and provide the new Supreme Court majority with the opportunity to cut back on Roe or maybe overturn Roe.
That's always the hope. The ultimate hope of the pro-life lobby is that it wants to overturn Roe, overturn Casey. And,
right.
And if it can't do that, then enact as many restrictions as possible within the Casey rule, trying to convince some lower federal court probably that whatever the restriction is not an undue burden.
Correct. That's the current name of the game.
That's the current name of the game. If I recall correctly, one of the most recent issues that's out there is in the state of Mississippi, where they have enacted such a statute, and the statute requires doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. And this has resulted in the near closure, or perhaps the closure, of the last abortion clinic in the state of Mississippi.
Right, right. I mean, access in big parts of the country is becoming quite difficult, and of course that's exacerbated by these waiting periods. And so if a woman has to travel a long distance, take time off from work, you know, many, many women seeking abortions already have children, so, you know, child care at home or whatever, it's becoming what's quite a simple thing in a city like New York is becoming a real challenge financially and time-wise in other parts of the country.
It'll be interesting to see how that case comes out in Mississippi because, of course, it does have such a dramatic effect in terms of limiting access to abortion, and also because some of the people involved in enacting the statute were very very upfront about it. They said that's why we want the statute to be enacted. And
well, and you know, one thing in terms of the demographics of abortion today, there are about 1 million abortions a year in the country. Basically, one out of every four pregnancies ends in abortion. But more and more abortion is being utilized by poor women and women of color and lower socioeconomic strata because middle-class women are availing themselves of the very reliable, long-lasting birth control that's available now. Mm-hmm. That's expensive, and that's part of the contraception mandate controversy that's going on now in the country. These long-lasting hormonal contraception is really cutting down on unintended pregnancy. Basically, in this country, half of all pregnancies are unintended, and half of those end in abortion. So the more access to contraception, of course, the fewer unintended pregnancies and the fewer abortions. So the unintended pregnancy problem is being kind of forced down the socioeconomic ladder because of this disparity in access to reliable contraception. That's part of the picture.
There is a whole nother issue. In fact, we did a whole nother show on that so-called contraceptive mandate quite recently, but it's interesting how it ties into the abortion debate. We're just about out of time, Linda. Any final thoughts on this? Any prognostications on the future of Casey and Roe?
Well, I guess my prognostication is we'll still have occasion to talk about this in the coming years. It's never going to be completely over.
Well, I sure hope that when it's appropriate that we can have you come back and talk to us some more because I don't know about you, but I sure as heck have enjoyed this conversation.
Okay, well, that's the deal.
And that's our show. I really hope that you enjoyed listening to Linda Greenhouse tell us all about Roe versus Wade, just a half as much, maybe a quarter as much as I enjoyed speaking to her. That was a fascinating tale from before the beginning to the present day and beyond. And I am going to take Linda up on her offer to come back on the show. She's just a wealth of knowledge about all kinds of things. And thank you, Linda, for speaking to us. And it is, of course, our second birthday, and we are, of course, happy to be here. When we started this 2 years ago, we weren't certain we would be here 2 years later, but now we're not just on one station, we're on several stations. We broadcast all over the Commonwealth of Virginia, and maybe you're listening to us on the radio now. If you're listening to us on the radio, we also have a podcast. It's on iTunes. We've got 85 episodes, I think, already, each one of them a different subject in constitutional law. Please check us out online. If you're listening to a podcast, well, we're also a public radio show. And if we don't happen to be broadcasting now on your local public radio station, give them a call. Tell them about your weekly constitutional. Tell them that we'd like to join their lineup. Before I go, I'd like to wish a happy birthday to our executive producer, Wayne Winkler. Happy birthday, Wayne.
Happy birthday, Stuart.
And that, of course, was Wayne Winkler, our executive producer. Our distribution engineers are Larry Mayer and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.